right, I need the lawyers in the next case, please. Mr. Harrison, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Judge, and your honors. Mick Harrison for the appellants. Dr. Lokesh Weyuru et al. I have with me co-counsel Mr. Smith at counsel table and the amicus counsel, Mr. Savage. Dr. Weyuru was a prominent doctor in Virginia. He had his medical license revoked in 2006 by the Board of Medicine. He attempted at the time of his first hearing to present evidence that this revocation action was in retaliation for protected whistleblowing, including disclosing Medicare fraud. The board would not let him put that evidence into the record. Dr. Weyuru found during depositions after his revocation hearing that there was a fraud on the court perpetrated in that hearing. That included destruction of evidence by staff members of the Board of Medicine and the Attorney General's office, perjury and the subordination of perjury, retaliation regarding his newspaper articles. Dr. Weyuru also at that time was publisher of a newspaper. There was false testimony by the board's only expert. The fraud resulted in the application of a double standard by the Board of Medicine regarding the disqualification of experts. Dr. Weyuru's experts in significant part being disqualified, and the board's not, even though the facts were, had they been known, similar for both sets of experts. Dr. Weyuru attempted is the key word, to present his newly discovered evidence by way of these depositions and some new documents he obtained to the circuit court on direct appeal of the Board of Medicine decision. He offered those depositions, and the circuit court declined to allow them into the record. So Dr. Weyuru never had an opportunity, and hasn't actually had until this day, an opportunity to ever put on his evidence of the fraud on the court that resulted in the revocation of his license. Now, Dr. Weyuru believes, as hopefully we all do, that the courts provide at some point a remedy for a fraud on the court, that at some point you get your day in court, you get to be heard. If you don't prove it up, you don't get relief. But you get to put on your evidence, and the court decides and has some obligation to decide a fraud on the court claim. But to this day, that hasn't happened. Now, the district court, as your honors know, dismissed Dr. Weyuru's subsequent claims brought in a federal action under RICO, Virginia abuse of process, and Virginia business conspiracy. All those claims were dismissed. And one of the primary grounds the district court relied on to dismiss those claims for the public defendants, emphasize for the public defendants, not the private defendants. But the claim preclusion was used to dismiss the claims against the public defendants. Now, Dr. Weyuru's claims, RICO, abuse of process, business conspiracy, are intimately intertwined with those actions that constitute the fraud on the court. And Dr. Weyuru asserted a fraud on the court defense to claim preclusion in the district court. In other words, a judgment that might otherwise be preclusive is not preclusive, does not have preclusive effect, and in fact has no effect if it is void because of a fraud upon the court. So it was Dr. Weyuru's position, and remains his position, that the district court had an obligation before dismissing his claims on claim preclusion to hear and decide the evidence of the fraud on the court to determine, was that prior Virginia judgment or judgments, there was more than one at issue, were they really preclusive? Under the law of Virginia, as under federal law, a judgment obtained by fraud upon the court is void, is of no legal effect, and therefore of no preclusive effect. So the first major error that we're concerned about is, you know, Dr. Weyuru didn't get a chance to explain his fraud on the court evidence to the district court, so the district court can make an informed decision whether the underlying prior proceedings had preclusive effect. And we're still looking for that opportunity. show that they do not. Now, if you look at the briefs, or if an outside observer were to look at these briefs, you would say this is a complex case with many issues, claim preclusion, RICO immunity, a number of complex matters. However, the appeal could be simply decided if it turns out that appellant is correct on their local Rule 7E argument, which is very simple. And it goes like this. The defendants made their motions to dismiss and their motions for sanctions. The local rule gave them 30 days to set those motions for hearing. Under that local rule, if the defendants don't set their motions for hearing, the rule, by action of law, requiring nothing further, deems those motions withdrawn. And so those motions actually no longer legally existed.
You missed a part of that, unless the court otherwise directs. Right?
That is in the rule, unless the court otherwise directs. Now, the way I read that rule, Judge Diaz, is that if the court were to issue an order before the expiration of those 30 days and say, defendants, you have 6 months to set this for hearing, or defendants and plaintiffs have agreed no hearing is required, or the hearing will be set on a certain date, there are a number of ways the judge by order could avoid the automatic application of Local Rule 7E.
Or the court simply rules on the motions without a hearing.
Within those 30 days. That rule is very clear. It's automatic. It's specific. Whether it's a good rule or not is another question. But the way it works, by its plain language, is if the movement doesn't set their motion for hearing in 30 days or get an agreement of the other party to submit without a hearing, those motions are withdrawn. And that's what happened here. And so those motions should not have been decided by the district court at the time they were decided.
When I was looking at that issue, I was looking to see if there was any prejudice to you from the fact that they were decided. And I saw some general statements that we had other evidence or we could have provided more information, but it was never anything specific that submitted to the court. And there's a lot of generalities, but nothing specific, so I don't see where the prejudice is.
Well, there is prejudice, Your Honor. It's a good question. And the primary prejudice is for the motions to dismiss, the plaintiffs wanted to explain to the court what I'm attempting to explain to Your Honors, which is there was fraud on the court in the prior proceedings, therefore those prior proceedings have no preclusive effect. And we actually wanted to offer some of that evidence of fraud on the court, and we believed, and still believe, that the district court had an obligation to entertain that evidence of fraud on the court in a hearing before determining preclusive effect.
But did you ever offer it and say, look, Judge, look at this evidence. This will change your mind.
Well, that's actually, we intended to do that in the hearing. We were planning to, upon the scheduling of the hearing, make a motion to determine, like, how much evidence can we present? Will we get discovery? We were waiting patiently on our colleagues on the other side of the V to let us know what was happening with those negotiations on the hearing. As it turns out, we found out later, this is the ex parte communication issue and the disqualification issue, that the defendant's counsel had communicated with someone in the court's office about whether a hearing needed to be scheduled. The outcome of that discussion turned out to be no hearing was scheduled, but the plaintiffs were never informed of that decision to not have a hearing. So, it's a complicated situation where the ex parte communication exacerbates the situation about not getting a hearing, which exacerbates our ability to show there shouldn't be preclusive effect. And so we think there was a substantial prejudice here. This is not a typical case. I think oral argument is helpful and would have been to the district court, and I think evidence, more to the point, would have been helpful for the district court. So the problem that we now face, and I think that Your Honors have to decide, is what is the consequence of a district court applying claim preclusion to dismiss a claim without hearing evidence of fraud on the court when it is alleged? And our position is that when fraud upon the court is alleged, and in this case alleged with specificity and with some supporting evidence, that somewhere along the line, a court has to hear that evidence and decide the fraud on the court claim. If you're going to apply claim preclusion to deny a hearing on the merits, in the face of an allegation of fraud on the court, and you're going to deny a hearing on fraud on the court, what you're really denying is meaningful access to the courts. You're denying a meaningful opportunity to be heard. That's a due process problem. It's a denial of the constitutional right of the petition to redress and of access to the courts. So when you apply both claim preclusion in the way the court applied it and fail to decide the fraud on the court issue, you create a constitutional problem. Effectively, the district court's rule would insulate, and in this case does insulate, fraud on the court from judicial review unless your honors decide that somewhere in this lengthy series of proceedings, Dr. Uyuru does get his day in court on his fraud on the court allegations. We hope you do, and we believe that would be consistent with Supreme Court decisions, including Hazel Atlas.
Isn't the type of fraud that you're alleging intrinsic fraud, which would make a judgment voidable as opposed to void?
It's a good question, Your Honor. I apologize. Under my understanding of both federal and Virginia law on fraud and fraud on the court, if the fraud alleged substantially prevents a party from fairly and fully presenting their case, is considered extrinsic fraud. A typical case might be misconduct by an officer of the court. It might be preventing a party from actually filing their claim or getting to the courthouse would be another example.
You mean physically preventing them from getting there?
Or tricking them in some way by, let's say, some false representation. But in this case...
You're talking about testimony and evidence.
Well...
Aren't you?
What I'm trying to say is that any substantial pattern of conduct that prevents a full and fair presentation of a case is fraud on the court, and in this case, we have such a pattern. Now, if you took Dr. Domley's false testimony standing alone, and you didn't have the Assistant Attorney General encouraging him not to change his testimony after he reviewed 1,900 pages of patient records, which is what happened, if that wasn't there, if you didn't have destruction of evidence in advance of the hearing by staff of the AG's office and the Board of Medicine, which caused a double standard to be applied, and you didn't have destruction of other evidence, you didn't have the concealment of retaliation by the hospitals in complaining about the newspaper articles that were making exposés, if you didn't have all those things and you just had false testimony in isolation, I would agree with Your Honor, it would be intrinsic fraud. But the pattern taken together effectively prevented Dr. Uyuru from presenting his case, and that's why it's extrinsic fraud. My time is up, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Let's
Thank
hear
you.
From Mr. Savage.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Rudolph Savage, attorney from Bloomington, Indiana, and I'm representing the amici curiae here today. My clients are three distinguished doctors from New York and Louisiana, and their concern and why they asked to participate as amici in this case is that they have an interest, as does Dr. Uyuru, in safeguarding the integrity of the medical profession. Dr. Christopher Malavrapu is a cardiologist out of Lafayette, Louisiana. He shares an experience like Dr. Uyuru's in that several years ago, a colleague in his hospital, Dr. Malavrapu, discovered that this colleague was doing unnecessary heart stent procedures. He brought this to the local U.S. Attorney's Office's attention, and after an extensive investigation, a conviction was obtained against this colleague. Dr. Golding, Michael Golding, is a member of the Board of Professional Medical Conduct in the state of New York. In that capacity, he serves to protect the integrity of the medical profession and protect the public from malfeasance of medical professionals. Dr. Rao Adagata is a colleague of Dr. Uyuru's. He was his mentor back when Dr. Uyuru was getting his training. He's known Dr. Uyuru for years, and he's concerned, as is Dr. Uyuru, about safeguarding the integrity of the medical profession. The medical profession, like the legal profession, is largely self-policing. And in order for the self-policing mechanisms to work, that medical prof- professional boards like Dr. Golding's rely on honest doctors who observe wrongdoing coming forward and blowing the whistle, which is what Dr. Weiru alleges he did in this case. The Amakai's concern, and why we're here today, is that they're very concerned about the chilling effect that could be set by the precedent in this case, that whistleblowers would be deterred from coming forward. Dr. Weiru has alleged that he was retaliated against because he came forward after exposing Medicaid fraud, Medicare fraud, insurance, and other billing fraud. And the retaliation was that he was brought before the Board of Medicine and his license was taken away. Well, he's also alleging that that was done through a fraud on the tribunal, an extrinsic fraud on the tribunal that involved destruction of evidence and perjured testimony, evidence that he's never had a chance to bring before a court and fully expose. He's never had a full hearing. So the precedent that would be set by allowing that situation to stand and go unaddressed in court is that the message will be sent to potential whistleblowers. If you have the guts to stand up and expose something that's going wrong with a colleague, you're liable to be a subject of retaliation. And if the powers that you're fighting against get away with it the first time around, you'll never have a chance because of this application of claim preclusion to ever bring your case to court and prove your allegations that you were the victim of a fraudulent licensing procedure. Performing unnecessary procedures is something that would be difficult to detect. I think it takes a medical professional to know, because of the nuances of practice of medicine, whether a heart stent needs to be done or whether a gastroenterological procedure, as in Dr. Weiru's case, has to be done. So the medical profession has to rely on doctors being willing to come forward. Nobody else can do it. And if a doctor is going to be a victim of a retaliatory procedure against his license, then they're going to be reluctant to come forward, and the medical profession will suffer. That's the Amakai's interest in this case, is to deter and not allow that chilling effect to remain in place. We urge the court to send the case back to the district court and allow Dr. Weiru finally his opportunity to fully vent and expose all the fraud that took place in the licensing procedure. The judgment of the licensing panel is void and of no effect.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Savage. Mr. Russell.
May it please the court, Wes Russell, Office of the Attorney General, on behalf of the Commonwealth Appellees, but I will be addressing both the claim preclusion arguments, the Rule 7e argument, and the motions to dismiss as they apply to all the appellees. Mr. Pace will be addressing the district court's appropriate award of sanctions, and also at table is Mr. Byram, another counsel for the private appellees. I wish I could say that, as in the normal course of most appeals, this would be the beginning of hopefully the last chapter of this case, but the record demonstrates that no matter what happens here today, unless the district court's full order is affirmed, we're likely to be back with many of the same players and probably a couple additional ones, probably me, for the next go-round. In fact, during the very pendency of this appeal, there was another claim filed in state court in Chesterfield Circuit Court, which Judge Gill dismissed with prejudice and by a letter opinion in August, and in fact I think the final order in that case covering the Commonwealth defendants on the same basic facts is still circulating. We get to play this movie over and over again as if it were Groundhog Day. Turning to the government defendants and claim preclusion and immunity, the findings of the district court in that regard, I think it's important to note that the claim preclusion doctrines are there to make sure that every litigant gets one bite at the apple, but not necessarily a second bite. Counting the QI-TAM action, the administrative appeal, and all the various collateral actions that Dr. Weiru has filed, we're now at the eighth bite at the apple. There's no apple left. And in fact, regarding this case, of course, this is on an amended complaint in this case, so it's truly a ninth bite at the apple. Because of comedy, the federal courts must give the preclusive effect that the state court would have given its own judgments, because it's the state court judgment in the initial administrative proceeding plus some of the subsequent state court proceedings that really bar the action, and so the rules were summarized correctly by the district court. You must have the same parties or their privies. I think there's no question we meet that prong. The claim has to arise out of the same series of transactions or occurrences. There's no dispute among the parties that we meet that prong. The plaintiff raised or could have raised in any one of the prior proceedings the issues raised here. The witness bias, the alleged coaching of the witness, all could have been raised. Furthermore, there have been collateral attacks on the initial judgment in state court since, and the record reflects that. The 2007 case against the aptly named Ms. Twombly and Hardy in the Chesterfield Circuit Court. Opportunities to collaterally attack this judgment were available, they just weren't used to full effect. The appeal to the Court of Appeals of Virginia listed 26 questions presented, and as the Court of Appeals said in its opinion, the appellant procedurally defaulted 24 of them by not following the Court of Appeals rules. These opportunities existed, they just weren't utilized to the effect that the appellant seeks. And finally, there has to be a final judgment. Well, clearly there was a final judgment. You had the initial, there are multiple final judgments here, quite frankly, but starting with the initial administrative proceeding, there was the appeal to the Chesterfield Circuit Court, there was the ruling of the Court of Appeals, and then there was appeal to the Virginia Supreme Court, which denied the appeal. That's as final as a judgment gets in Virginia. An administrative agency, a circuit court review of the administrative agency, a Court of Appeals review of the circuit court, and then the Virginia Supreme Court reviewing a petition for appeal. It doesn't get more final than that. Turning next to the findings regarding Directors Harp and Nebaker on quasi-judicial immunity, the court correctly found that they were acting in a quasi-judicial role and were entitled to immunity unless bad faith was alleged. And despite all the things that are alleged in this record, there is nothing in the First Amended complaint that suggests that either Harp or Nebaker did anything in bad faith. Therefore, judicial immunity applies. The district court, recognizing that Richter is an unpublished decision of this court, relied on that anyway and noted that previously the directors of the Board of Medicine had been given quasi-judicial immunity. Turning to the AG, the four attorney general defendants, Pedrotti, Stanwix, Yagman, and McDonald, the allegations against Yagman and McDonald, there are really no facts alleged at all other than that they happen to be attorneys general. Regarding the allegations against Pedrotti and Stanwix, they are fall squarely within the doctrine of prosecutorial immunity. There were no allegations suggesting that they did something outside of dealing with a witness and presenting evidence. Now, the argument is, but they did it in some evil, nefarious way. Well, that's the whole point of immunity doctrines for prosecutors. You're going to always have somebody who's willing to say that they did something in an improper or nefarious way regarding the conduct of their office. At the end of most prosecutions, somebody's not happy. But the bottom line is, it was they're dealing with a witness and the putting on of evidence. That's the prosecutorial function. They're entitled to absolute immunity.
How about, before you run out of time, explain to me the local rule and what was going on when
the local
there was ex parte contact with the district court's office, which is acceptable under the rules, although there was a representation, I think, made by the plaintiff that according the timesheets, that conversation lasted an hour and a half. But for whatever reason, then there were misrepresentations made as to whether or not the plaintiff had participated in those conversations.
Well,
explain to me your view of what's going on.
Well, I think the Rule 7E argument is much ado about nothing. And Mr. Pace will go into, I think, some detail as to how he's going to argue the sanctions, but one of the things you raised was an alleged 1.5 hour time entry by former Attorney General Steve Rosenthal. If you actually look at the time entry on the bill, it's for about 5 or 6 different things, but there's only one amount of time. And so a 30-second phone conversation is misrepresented to this court as an hour and a half.
Okay.
The way Rule 7E has always worked in practice for lawyers, at least in my experience, is if you file a motion and you don't believe it requires a hearing, and sometimes in the Eastern District of Virginia, they rule before you make the call, and which they clearly have the right to do, you call up and you say, we don't think it needs a hearing. If the court agrees with you, you don't. Is the better practice to involve the plaintiff's counsel or the opposing counsel in that conversation? Absolutely. Is it required by the rule? No, for the reasons the court just stated. It's not an impermissible ex parte contact to contact the court about scheduling.
It sounds like you're saying that the rule is ignored.
The rule, it's not ignored. The 30 days is you either have to call the court and get a date, or you call the in practice, or you call the court and say, we don't need a hearing.
Right.
And then the court can, in this case, took 5 months to, so I think anybody who wanted to have a hearing, because both parties can request it, had plenty of time. And then, of course, there was a motion for reconsideration, so I'm really at a loss as to what the prejudice was. And as Your Honor pointed out, it seems to me that if you have evidence of this fraud that would have would void all the judgments, although I think it's at best voidable, I don't think it's void even under their best day, that would have been the time to come forward with it and not say, well, we were never given an opportunity, so we haven't really gotten to show our stuff. There was a lengthy motion for reconsideration that Judge Spencer conducted. That would have been the time to bring that forward. The reason it's not brought forward is there's no there. Only when you can talk in conclusory allegations is it that there's a possibility that there's a there, can they maintain the argument. When actually given the opportunity to put it on at the motion for reconsideration, they didn't. And that takes us to the Rule 12b-6. It's Iqbal and Twombly. The court is more than well familiar with those standards. I find it interesting that Iqbal involved allegations regarding an attorney general in a supervisory capacity not being sufficiently pled. We have that here. Twombly involved the failure to plead specific facts regarding a conspiracy and basically condemn the practice of just going to the horn book looking for the elements and sticking them in there without facts to support them. And of course, we have that here. I can go through the abusive process claim. I can go through the business conspiracy claim. I can go through the RICO claims. I think our brief does that rather well. I think Judge Spencer's opinion in the district court spells all of his reasons out with great specificity. And so if the court doesn't have any specific questions about any of those on the 12b-6, I'll turn it over to Mr. Pace to discuss the same.
Let me just make sure I understand your position on that issue, and that is that's an independent ground, even if for some reason we happen to disagree on this issue of claim preclusion, that the court considered the claims on the merits and found them to be deficient as a matter of law.
Absolutely. And we've heard no argument from the other side here today as to why the district court erred on the 12b-6, and of course then we would be entitled to judgment on that ground alone, which would be another preclusive judgment regarding everything, because 12b-6 is on the merits. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Pace.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ben Pace from Williams Mullen, and I represent appellant Dr. Jadhav. I'm arguing on behalf of all the appellants regarding the sanctions that were imposed below. I'm obviously going to argue that the lower court's judgment should be affirmed. While I appreciate the counsel for Amicus being here, and I appreciate Appley's appellant's argument that this is a case about a chilling effect on a whistleblower, the history that Amicus counsel described of his client of having reported what he believed to be improper medical procedures and having a federal prosecution conducted that resulted in a conviction is very different from the record in this case. And in fact, the public interest at stake in this case, if you look at the history of vexatious lawsuits filed by Dr. Uyuru and his entities over the years, the real public interest at stake is the sanctity of the peer review process and the government entities that investigate physicians to protect patients. This is now an almost 8-year crusade that Dr. Uyuru has been on to sue and publish articles in his newspaper critical of any entity or person that he felt was at all responsible for the loss of his license. And he started the campaign before the board proceeding was completed, which I think clearly shows his intent to use these numerous vexatious lawsuits as collateral attacks on the people that were involved in that decision-making process. Now, the district court awarded two separate sanctions below. One sanction was against appellant's counsel, Mr. Smith, for 10% of the attorney's fees that appellees incurred below, which was about $18,000, was the award of sanctions there. The district court also issued, imposed a pre-filing injunction against Dr. Wiyuru, and I want to point out that it was a narrowly tailored pre-filing injunction that only prevents him from filing lawsuits based on the board's revocation of his license in March of 2006 and only in federal court. Dr. Wiyuru and his counsel have already availed themselves of state court, as Mr. Russell pointed out, filing a state court action in Chesterfield Circuit Court alleging fraud on the court and multiple other counts related to all of these allegations that he's now saying should have been heard by the court before he ruled on the preclusion. And Judge Gill in Chesterfield Circuit Court just weeks ago dismissed that yet again. So he's still filing lawsuits even after the sanctions that have been filed in this case. As an initial matter, the first sanction that was imposed, the attorney's fees against Mr. Smith, as you can see in our brief and from the record on this appeal, it was clear to appellees that Mr. Smith failed to note his appeal in this case. Rule 3C1 in the Rules of Appellate Procedure requires that parties specify the parties taking the appeal by naming each one in the caption or body of the notice, while Rule 3C4 states that a party whose intent to appear is otherwise clear from the notice won't be precluded from pursuing their appeal. If you look at the case law from the other circuits, I don't believe the Fourth Circuit has ruled on it, it's clear that when an attorney is sanctioned individually below and he fails to name himself in the caption or in the body of the notice, he's failed to make it objectively clear under all the circumstances that he intends to appeal. And we've cited cases from the 11th Circuit, 2nd Circuit, and 6th Circuit that all arrive at the same conclusion. And in this case, all the circumstances includes the fact that local rule 3B of this court requires appellants to file a docketing statement. That includes listing of all the appellants. And in this case, Mr. Smith filed the docketing statement in October of 2011. And again, he did not list himself as an appellant. That's why we put in our brief, it does not appear that he's appealed this. When he filed his reply brief, he said, oh no, I am appealing. We think he's waived his appeal. And even if this court were to allow him to pursue his appeal, you're reviewing the award of sanctions under an abuse of discretion standard, and the findings of fact that Judge Spencer made below are reviewed for clear error. And the claims here were clearly unsupported in law, and they lacked evidence to support them. Mr. Russell didn't get into it too deeply, and obviously the brief, our brief, discusses it in detail. But if the thing that stands out to me, if you review their brief on appeal, their opening brief, they spent about one sentence defending their RICO claims. The most complex claims that they asserted, with numerous elements that have to be specifically alleged under a heightened pleading standard. And they spent one sentence, and basically what they said was, although we don't put it forth as a model RICO pleading, it's not even a model RICO pleading that they could have pulled out of a horn book, if we'd had more time and if we could have amended a few more times, we could have come up with something that would have allowed our RICO claims to go forward. That's sanctionable. They admit, even on appeal, that it wasn't a model RICO claim and that they needed more allegations to make it stick. One thing they don't point out is that they actually had two bites at the apple in their allegations in their complaint, because we filed our first motion to dismiss their original complaint, and after we filed that, they amended their complaint. They had the right to file an amended complaint as of right. They did, and so we had to file a second motion to dismiss. Of course, the allegations didn't change much. They dropped some parties. They dropped a few of the former attorneys general. They've dropped a few of the entities that we pointed out they had zero allegations in their complaint against. But just to briefly walk through how valid Judge Spencer's decision in ruling that the claims asserted below had absolutely no chance of success on the merits, the abuse of process claim, there's not even an allegation that process was issued, which is the first element that has to be satisfied to state a claim. the claim is against Dr. Domla, the expert witness. He didn't issue any process, and it's clear from the precedent that a witness testifying in a proceeding such as this cannot be guilty of an abusive process claim. The conspiracy claims are both subject to heightened pleading requirements under Rule 9 and under the case law regarding RICO, and you have to have specific allegations as to the who, what, when, where of these conspiracies, of the enterprise that was created, of the predicate acts. Judge Spencer pointed out he didn't have any of this. And not only did he not have it when he filed it initially, he didn't have it after we gave him our motion to dismiss that explained what the deficiencies were. And then after Judge Spencer dismissed it, he filed a motion to reconsider, further alleging that he could bring more, but never specifying exactly what more he could bring. So what we're dealing with today isn't just his allegation that, well, I have some fraud on the court in the underlying administrative proceeding, and I need my day in court on that. We're dealing with his allegations that he's never brought forth for the claims he's presented in this suit. As Judge Diaz pointed out, that's a separate grounds for dismissal of all his claims, separate and apart from the claim preclusion defense he raises here. To me, if you look at simply his allegations against sitting Governor McDonnell, former Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Virginia, he has no specific allegations about Governor McDonnell's role in any of these conspiracies or an abusive process or anything else, except he was the Attorney General when the prosecution for the revocation of his license began. That's frivolous. It was not based on a legitimate belief that there was a legal right to be advanced in this case. That's sanctionable. Regarding the pre-filing injunction, Judge Spencer correctly imposed a narrow injunction to attempt to deter Dr. Weyuru from abusing the judicial process and the further filing of meritless and repetitive actions. Before handing this down, he reviewed the extensive history. This court's familiar with it. In fact, when looking at the element of the history of vexatious litigation, this court need only look to its own precedent from the previous Ketam suit when we were here. This court affirmed Judge Payne's decision that his Ketam case was vexatious and frivolous. And the record which we've made in both our motion for sanctions and in our brief of his litigious history, again, suits filed against the board investigators while the board investigation was ongoing, filed against the witnesses who testified against him in peer review and at the board proceeding, filed against attorneys general and their staffs, and anyone else he thought played a role in the loss of his license. Really, if you, and I'll make this point very, very briefly as my time's running out, the only argument he makes with any vigor on appeal regarding why the sanctions should be overturned is that he didn't have a hearing. Well, Rule 11 says Judge Spencer may ask attorneys and parties to show cause why they shouldn't be sanctioned, why they shouldn't have a pre-filing injunction entered, and he did that here. He asked them to show cause. We had a hearing not just on the show cause order, but also a hearing on their motions to reconsider all of the rulings, a two-hour hearing at which they were able to make all the points that they're attempting now to make on appeal and say they weren't given the opportunity to make.
Thank you, Ms. Bates.
Thank you.
Mr. Harrison, you have some time reserved.
I do.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. The counsel for the defendants indicates that in the prior litigation, Dr. Weyuru could have raised the claims that he brought in the current federal action that have been dismissed. But there really is no prior proceeding where there was a decision on the merits of Dr. Weyuru's claims or where that court allowed Dr. Weyuru to present his evidence of fraud on the court. So in order for there to be a could have been raised opportunity, there has to be a situation where the court said, okay, we're going to decide this claim on his merits and we're going to hear your evidence. And that hasn't happened on the fraud on the court allegations yet. In terms of the immunity question, part of the relief Dr. Weyuru seeks is injunctive relief to stop the retaliation against him, particularly regarding his medical license. He's also complaining of administrative and investigative acts by some of the officials, including destruction of evidence pre-hearing. So the immunity argument can't be applied carte blanche across all of the issues in this case. It doesn't dispose of all of Dr. Uyuru's claims, even if it applies to the public defendants as argued by the defendants and found by the district court, because it's not just money damages we're seeking. We're trying to stop a pattern of retaliation. We're also trying to get damages for acts that were harmful, part of the fraud on the court, but happened in an administrative or investigative, not a judicial or prosecutorial capacity. So the immunity question isn't as simple as put forward. I don't know exactly why defendants say the Rule 7E argument is much ado about nothing, but every time I inadvertently fail to follow a rule, I notice that it is a consequential action. Courts do expect me to follow the rules, and I think all the parties are expected to do that. And there's case law we've cited that the courts are expected to follow their own rules as well. There's a process for waiving them that wasn't used here. Counsel saying it's a better practice, but not required by the rule, to involve the opposing party in setting a hearing, that's just not what Rule 7E says. What Rule 7E says is, if you, the movement, don't set your a motion for hearing in 30 days, your only other option is to arrange with the opposing party to submit it without a hearing. You can't just ignore the opposing party. Your Honor, I don't have time to address the details of the allegations in terms of stating claims for RICO, abuse of process, and business conspiracy, but I will say that the abuse of process claim we believe is well stated. Your Honors can judge by what's stated in the complaint, keeping in mind that count incorporates by reference the other allegations in the complaint, not just what's under that count heading. So the abuse of process, there was a Board of Medicine proceeding here against Dr. Uyuru. It involved process. He was served with notice. It involved process in the broader sense. My time is up, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. We'll come down and greet counsel and then take about a 5 or 10 minute break.